Thank you, Deputy Vice Chancellor. Thank you, everybody, for coming this evening. My title, as you can see, is Outsourcing, Offshoring and the Global Factory. And what I want to do in my lecture, just to give you a brief overview of how I'm going to structure it, is firstly say something about changes in the distribution of global economic activity. And then secondly, to actually define some terms here. Outsourcing, offshoring, and even this idea of a global factory, these terms are bandied about and they're used in different ways. So before I sort of get down to some real meat of the lecture, to say a little bit about what I mean by these terms, what I think these terms refer to. And then I want to address three main issues in my talk. Firstly, what evidence is there for this idea of a global factory, whatever we mean by that? Secondly, to, if you like, the sort of the main part of my talk is looking at why are firms choosing to outsource activities? If one takes a historical point of view, I think for most of the 20th century, there was firms were internalizing more and more activities, vertically integrating activities. And it seems over the last 10, 20 years that this trend towards outsourcing has taken place. So why is that? What explanations can we have for that? And then lastly, to talk about, again, coming on to one of my other interests, how is this global factory, however we're going to define it, how is it governed? How is it controlled? So that's the sort of general plan of my lecture. Just a few sort of introductory comments about the distribution of economic activity in the global economy. And without going into a lot of detail, I think we can all say that over the last 30 years, there have been dramatic changes. And I could put up lots and lots of slides with lots and lots of data to illustrate this, but I'll spare you that. And what's been driving all of this? Probably four major factors. I'm sure we could all come up with other things, but four major factors, it seems to me. Liberalisation in all kinds of economies, in Eastern Europe, in Asia, in Latin America, all around the world. Financial deregulation and integration of financial markets. Moves towards trade and investment liberalisation, and this includes the creation of preferential trading agreements around the world, the setting up of all kinds of bilateral trade agreements, etc., etc. And these have all been driving further trade and the relocation of activity. And also technological advantages, particularly in ICT, information and communication technologies, but also transportation. And some people have argued this makes the world a much smaller place. So I think these, we probably all agree, with a little bit of give and take, that these are the major things going on which have resulted in sort of fairly major changes in the distribution of economic activity. And these are some figures just for, I think it's for 2009, just to give some sense of the situation now, rather than tracking it over 30 years. Breaking up the world into three groups of economies, advanced economies, which is Western Europe, North America, Japan. Developing economies, lots of economies in Africa and elsewhere. And the emerging economies. And yes, how does one define emerging economies? Especially over time, that's of course a moot issue. But this is a class of economies that would include Brazil, Russia, India, China, the BRIC economies, and many others which are developing very quickly. And when one just looks at a snapshot in 2009, and if we look at the bottom line of figures here, percentage of world GDP, and one can see that the advanced economies are accounting now for 48% of world GDP, and those emerging economies coming up very quickly, 43%. And probably if I had the figures for 2010, figures of 2011, those two figures would be a lot closer. And yet, if I had the figures back for 1980 and looked at exactly the same figures, I guess that the advanced economies would probably be 60, 70%, and those emerging economies would be down about 10, 20%. So big changes have occurred. And so this, of course, is something of interest to us all, this change in the location of economic activity. And that's like led a lot of people to talk about the idea of a global factory. And as I'll come back to say in a few minutes' time, different people have used this term in different ways. But the idea that manufacturing activity, economic activity is being spread further and wider across the world is a fairly sort of common idea. But what has received rather less attention, and this is what sort of interests me rather more, is who controls all these activities, these geographically dispersed activities? Or to put it in a rather more pithy phrase, looking at the governance of the global factory. So, some definitions. What do I mean by outsourcing? What do I mean by offshoring? What do I mean by the global factory? Again, if one reads the literature on these things, you get all kinds of conflicting definitions, sometimes used synonymously and sometimes used in completely different ways. To me, I use the term outsourcing to refer to a process. It's a process by which firms which previously did certain activities in-house, if you like, then decide at a point in time to get somebody else to do it, to pass on that activity to an independent supplier. So it's a change from a situation where everything was done in-house, the firm was all vertically integrated, it undertook all these activities, and then it decided to get somebody else to do it. And why does that happen at a particular point in time? And a rather more grand way of referring to outsourcing is it's an organisational fragmentation of production. The organisation is breaking up and various parts are being externalised to other companies. Offshoring, on the other hand, is about relocating activities overseas. It's about shifting activities from Britain to China or from France to Vietnam or taking activities somewhere else. And again, slightly longer phrase, here we have an international fragmentation of production. Activities which maybe used to all take place within one economy are now split up and some are put into different economies. And to my mind, these two things are conceptually different and they're driven by different things. And outsourced activities can take place within the same economy. You can outsource something, something you were doing previously in-house in your own firm, you can externalise that to an independent supplier, and that can be in the same country. Or it can be outsourced to a different firm overseas. And meanwhile, offshoring activities can take place within the firm. A firm might decide that, yes, producing in Britain, producing in France is too expensive. Let's offshore these activities to China, to Vietnam, to India. But we'll keep doing them ourselves. We'll keep doing them within our firm, in which case this is what we as international business scholars refer to as foreign direct investment, FDI for short. Or you can offshore these activities to independent firms. And so, as I say, outsourcing and offshoring, to my mind, are completely different, conceptually different activities. They can happen together, they can happen separately. And just to give a few examples of outsourcing, they come across a range of industrial sectors. Things like footwear, the famous, infamous example of Nike that everybody uses, I use in my lectures. 30 years ago, Nike used to produce all its trainers in-house. I see a couple of my international management students smiling at the back there. They heard this in one of my lectures. That we've sort of, yes, they used to do all their manufacturing in-house, and then over the years, they've outsourced it to independent suppliers in Taiwan, in Vietnam, in China, and all around the world. Clothing industry. A lot of the work in sort of the global value chain tradition has looked at the clothing industry and how firms like Marks and Spencers and Levi Strauss no longer do any of their own manufacturing. It's all outsourced to independent suppliers, wherever in the world they happen to be. Now, those are examples of fairly labour-intensive activities, and you think, oh, yes, maybe that's reasonable in those kinds of industries, but also increasingly in industries like pharmaceuticals, AstraZeneca, Pfizer. They've started to outsource their drug manufacture and the manufacture of the sort of pharmaceutical ingredients. And electronics as well, companies like Apple and Dell, outsourcing the manufacture of the components and the assembly of computers and other things. And although this isn't strictly relevant as an example of outsourcing, because I don't know whether Dell did all of these things in-house, it's quite a nice slide which shows how you know, let's call it a traditional sort of item that we all have, a laptop computer, where all the bits and pieces are made. When you pick up this is a Dell notebook computer, where do all the bits come from? Well, Dell doesn't manufacture all of them, and certainly not all the manufacture is done in America or somewhere. Bits are coming from China, bits are coming from Taiwan, bits are coming from all over the place. And basically, this is what we see in a whole range of industries, that the value chain activities are being split up and spread around the world. Some are happening within the company, some are being internalized, some are being outsourced. Last definition, the idea of a global factory. Now again, when I started looking up who's been writing about the global factory, ideas about a global factory, many people use this term in many different ways. Fairly early reference to it was some work by Gary Gareffi, who Hubert would know, for does a lot of work on global value chain analysis, and has probably changed his ideas since. But he was referring back in 1989 to global factory in the sense of the development of a global manufacturing system. So, if I can be so bold, to say a fairly simple characterization of the global factory, really just referring to the fact that manufacturing activity was being spread around the world. About the same kind of time, two gentlemen, Grunwald and Flam, also came up with a different conception of the global factory. And they were referring to it in a rather different way, sort of multinationals deciding to offshore lots of activities from advanced to emerging economies, largely because of cost advantages from doing this. And this, of course, to IB scholars, something we're familiar with from the works of Raymond Vernon, and even the Japanese scholars Kojima and Ozawa, the idea that firms will shift their activities overseas to where they can be done the cheapest. Then more recently, two gentlemen in the front row here, Peter Buckley and Pervez Gowrie, coming up with a different conception of the global factory. The idea that it's multinationals not only offshoring activities, but also outsourcing some of these activities. And their conception of the global factory, I have to say this because they're sitting in the front row here, I think is the most interesting of them. And basically, it's about multinationals engaging in a complex strategy to minimize their costs. The location costs of production, the transaction costs of moving goods around. And what they're setting up is distributed networks of activities around the world. And it's like bound together by flows of intermediate products, knowledge and intermediate goods and whatever else. So we're seeing flows of goods and knowledge moving around the world. And the multinationals are orchestrating these activities. But the control of a lot of this activity remains in the advanced economies where many of these multinationals come from. And these gentlemen would see this as an efficient response to changing economic conditions. The fact that the world economy, transportation costs are falling, all those things I was talking about right at the start of the lecture. And this is just multinationals reacting to this in an efficient way. We can put some of these activities in cheaper cost locations, so that's what we're going to do. And we can coordinate these activities much easier because of the other changes I was talking about. Now, that's my opening preamble. Now, I think there's at least three interesting questions that I want to address in the remainder of my lectures. Three possible models of the global factory. Which of these is actually the most realistic? Which is the most helpful to us? Secondly, going back to a question I kind of posed a few minutes ago, why are firms choosing to outsource activities? You know, firms which used to be vertically integrated, which used to keep everything in-house, used to produce parts and components and do it all within the firm, the multinational, why are they now choosing to pass it on to somebody else? What's changed? What's driven this change? And thirdly, what are the implications of these changes for the governance of the global factory? And therefore for industrial development, industrial policy in less developed countries, in the host economies, which are the recipients of a lot of this activity. Now, all of these models of the global factory. Which one do I think is the best? Well, I think they've all got something to say for them. And they all share sort of certain common assumptions, if you like. One is that technology has in some way enabled a lot of value chains to be broken up into stages, separate stages. Or as, again, the terminology, value chains become fine sliced. And we see it in that diagram of the Dell notebook, how different parts can be manufactured in different countries. Different parts and components can be manufactured in different countries, R&D activities can be done somewhere else, and then it's all brought together in another place. We see it in clothing, the textiles and clothing industry, that textiles are manufactured in some countries, they're then shipped to more low labour cost countries where the cloth is cut and sewn into garments, and then those garments are shipped back again to more advanced economies where they're sold. So we're seeing in a whole range of industries a breaking up of value chains. Different bits are being put into different parts of the world, sometimes within the same firms, sometimes in different firms. This is aided, of course, by some of the stages in these value chains tend to be labour-intensive and have modest skill requirements. So even in quite sophisticated things like notebook computers, there's a lot of assembly activities, and a lot of assembly activities effectively mean taking components, sticking them into boards, bolting things together. This is a labour-intensive activity, and this is the kind of thing that lends itself to being done in emerging economies, developing economies, where wage costs are much lower. And thirdly, what we see and what we observe is a much greater volume of international trade, not in finished goods, the computers, the finished clothing, the finished drugs or whatever it is, but in intermediate products, the bits and pieces that go into this, the textiles and the various bits that go into the clothing, the semiconductors, the screens, or whatever that go into electronics, automobile components as well. We're seeing an awful lot of trade, international trade, in these intermediate goods. And there's been a variety of studies sort of saying that about 30% of international trade these days is of these kind of intermediate goods. You know, our sort of the model of the idea sort of going back 30, 40 years, that what was traded was final goods, that goods were produced in Germany and all the parts and components produced in Germany and then that was exported somewhere else. That no longer holds true these days. Parts and components, bits and pieces are travelling across national boundaries with great regularity. So all of our models kind of share those kind of assumptions. So which of the models do I think is the most realistic? Well, my short answer is I think all of them have got some kind of... There's something to all of them. So if I turn firstly to Gareffi's global manufacturing system, the idea that basically activities, manufacturing activities, other activities are just being shifted to emerging economies, en bloc, if you like. Certainly what we observe is a wider distribution of economic activity. And we also observe quite a substantial growth of multinationals from emerging economies. You know, quite a lot of the sort of, you know, if you list all the major multinationals in the world, quite a lot of them are coming out of China, out of Russia, out of Brazil. So certainly we're seeing something of this model here. If we look at the Grunwald and Flam model, the offshoring and foreign assembly by multinationals, again, there seems to be something to this story as well. The latest World Investment Report put out by UNCTAD suggests that multinationals account for about 25% of world GDP. So multinationals are very much part of the story. And that value added by foreign affiliates within that 25% is about 40% of multinationals' value added. So there's certainly quite a lot of this sort of multinationals deciding to offshore activities, keep it in-house, and an awful lot of activity is of that kind. How about the offshoring and outsourcing model, if I put it, picking up on Peter Buckley and Pervez Gari's idea? Again, the same UNCTAD World Investment Report, for the first time has started trying to look at these issues of outsourcing, and offshoring, and try and come up with some numbers to try and quantify the scale of things here. And they reckon that in 2010, manufacturing and services outsourcing together, $1,100 to $1,300 billion worth. Quite a substantial amount. And yeah, what kind of industries is this happening in? Garments, of course, $200 billion worth of sales, 7 million employees. Footwear, companies like Nike, again, 50 billion sales, 2 million employees. Electronics, 240 billion of sales, 1.7 million employees. Auto components. Across a range of industries, we're seeing, these things are difficult to estimate, difficult to come up with numbers. But so it's really good that the UNCTAD has come up with some kind of estimates, give us some kind of sense of how large this phenomenon is. So in terms of which model of the global factory, my first issue, if you like, I think all three models have got something to say for them. They each describe sort of certain things going on in the world economy. So yes, there's an emergence of multinationals coming out of emerging economies. There is a shift in activity in that way, that emerging economies are spawning their own multinationals, their own firms, which are taking an increasing proportion of world output. There's also increasingly multinationals offshoring activities. And the amount of world GDP being accounted for by multinationals is also on the increase. And there's also obviously quite significant evidence that outsourcing activities is on the increase. And these numbers suggest quite substantial activity. So if I turn to my second question, why would firms want to outsource activity? If we think that at one point in time, probably they were doing everything in-house, and when you vertically integrate everything, you do everything in-house, you've got complete control over that, those activities. So why would firms want to outsource things to independent suppliers? And again, if one takes a sort of business history point of view and looks back over the last century or something, through the earlier part of the 20th century, even into the latter part of the 20th century, one could probably detect a trend towards firms internalizing more and more activities, not just the manufacturing, the distribution, the raw material supply, trying to keep it all in-house, trying to keep control over everything. And it's very difficult to sort of pinpoint, a turning point in a trend, especially something as big and as general as this. But maybe from about the 1980s onwards, so the last 20, 30 years, maybe we see a reverse trend of firms looking more and more to externalise activities. And initially, I would suggest this starts with what Michael Porter would have called support activities, the IT functions, the HR functions, the accounting functions in firms. But then latterly, we see it happening more and more in manufacturing activities, which again, one would have thought of, these are the absolute core activities which define a firm, is what they manufacture, what they produce. So why the change in this trend and why now? Well, a common explanation, if you sort of read around the literature, it's all down to information and communication technology. And what information and communication technology advances, the internet and email and whatever else, what this does is it reduces the transaction costs of carrying out exchanges through the market. And so it makes arm's length transactions cheaper, easier, and therefore firms are going to start externalizing things. And this enables smaller, more specialized firms to sort of take a role here. And hence, so the explanation goes, that's why we're seeing greater outsourcing and less vertical integration of firms, because ICT has allowed firms to do this. It's made it cheaper to buy in things. But I'd also argue, and not just me, other people would argue, that information and communication technologies also make it far easier to coordinate firms, to integrate firms. It's much easier to organise a multinational with subsidiaries out in Latin America and Australia and all around the world than it was 20 or 30 years ago. You can communicate with people via Skype or video conferencing instantly. You can travel there anywhere in the world in less than 24 hours. So actually coordinating activities around the world, a spatially dispersed organization, is far easier because of these new technologies. So we can make so this would sort of tend to favor vertical integration. And I've got powerful support for this idea that sort of new technologies favor vertical integration. If we go back 60 years, 70 years, Ronald Coase's very famous paper back in 1937, when the new technology was the telephone and the telegraph. And he, in a very famous article, sort of suggested that anything that reduces the cost of organizing something over a big geographical area will tend to lead to increases in sizes of firms. So if one, you know, you don't have to believe me, if you believe Ronald Coase and he got a Nobel Prize, I think one would say that ICT advances should lead to greater integration rather than greater outsourcing. So this ICT explanation to me doesn't seem to be a sufficient condition, if you like, for firms deciding to outsource more of their activities. It may be part of the explanation, but on its own, I don't think it provides the whole answer. And yet, when I read the literature, so many people suggest that it is the whole answer. So what other explanations can we come up with? Well, different people have come up with different explanations for it. Again, famous article back in 1990 by Prahalad and Hamel. It's all about firms concentrating on their core competencies. It's about concentrating what you're good at and you outsource the other stuff. You externalize the other stuff. To me, this begs the question, well, if this other stuff you weren't particularly good at in the first place, why were you doing it in-house? And why are you now deciding to externalize it? Or another line of explanation is it's all about taking advantage of other firms' complementary resources and capabilities. And again, if those external suppliers were there, why were you doing it all in-house in the first place? And a third line of argument was to take advantage of more efficient external suppliers. This, and it's sort of a variant on the second one there, that there are people out there who can do it better than you can, so let's get them to do it for us. And these three explanations are interlinked. But again, it begs the question to me of, if that's the case, why weren't you doing it 10 years ago? Why did you internalize things? So if I just skip over this bit and go on to the next slide briefly. Basically, all these explanations, what they're all emphasizing is efficient solutions, that it's somehow more efficient to externalize, to outsource activities. And I think they do have some merit if we're talking about support activities, the HR function, the IT functions in companies. There is certainly, you know, with something like IT, that it does make sense to get in specialist IT suppliers because they're more skilled at it, they can do it better, they can get economies of scale from doing it. But I don't think it really explains well some of those examples about manufacturing that I was talking about. Why does Nike, for example, outsource all of its footwear to independent suppliers? Surely Nike's got the expertise to set up its own factories in China or Vietnam and run them itself and produce those goods as efficiently as anybody else can, probably more so. Why does Dell decide to outsource production of its computers? It could probably produce all those things as cheaply as anybody else can. Why does Pfizer producing drugs? Certainly they could produce things as cheaply as somebody else can. So it seems to me that these explanations based on efficiency arguments, again, don't really seem to capture the essence of what's going on. And if I go back a slide to this fourth one, this is where my own modest contribution, but also the work of Gary Gareffi, John Humphrey, Hubert Schmitz, and the value chain people, I think, come in here, is it's all about firms being able to, these days, use their power and the control over these value chains to leverage greater profits out of value chains and push down prices. And rather than being an efficiency explanation, I think it's all about a sort of power explanation. And so what I would suggest has been happening and why we're seeing rather more outsourcing activities is that we have a power relationship between a lead firm and its suppliers. And yes, think of Nike and all its suppliers in China, in Vietnam, around the world. Nike has an enormous amount of power over them because the only company that can sell those Nike trainers is Nike itself. And if it doesn't like what that supplier is producing, the price it's producing it at, the cost, the price it's charging, or the quality, it says, forget you, I'll get somebody else in a different country, or somebody else over there, or somebody else over there, or somebody else over there. So it can use that power to really push down costs, to push down the prices it's having to pay for those trainers. And we can see the same thing in the pharmaceutical industry, in automobile components, in toys, in whatever other industry we look at. It's all about using your power as the lead firm to push down the prices from your suppliers. And here's where I say that ICT does have an impact, is that basically information communication technology, the internet and whatever else, it's increased competition. Every firm, even if it's a domestic firm, is competing with foreign firms. The world is, in some sense, at least one big market. So there's greater competition at all stages of the value chain. And so if you're not just going to be a as the economists would call it, a perfectly competitive firm, having your prices and your costs pushed down all the time, you've got to be able to have sort of control in some way. And what you've got to have control over is that interface with the final consumer. And it's being able to take control of that interface with the final consumer that enables you to keep prices high, to have power in the value chain, and to maintain control over that value chain, even if you've outsourced activities to independent suppliers. And how do you do that? There's a variety of ways you can do it. Robert Rumelt referred to isolating mechanisms, ways in which you can, if you like, keep competition at bay. One way of doing it, start at the bottom here, with branding. Yes, you've got Nike trainers. Who's the only, I'm saying lots of firms produce trainers, but there's only Nike who can sell Nike trainers under that name. And so they build up that brand image. You know, by recruiting Michael Jordan and other big figures, and they sell us an image that you buy this pair of Nike trainers, you can be a great basketball player. And other firms as well, whether it's sort of Levi Strauss jeans. We can all go down to Tesco's and buy a pair of jeans for £6. Or you can pay 10 times as much for a pair of Levi Strauss jeans. All of us, I guess, certainly younger people, maybe even older people, none of us would like to be seen in a pair of Tesco jeans unless it's just for doing the car repairs. So we're all prepared to pay far more just for the Levi Strauss brand name. And that means that Levi Strauss can earn a huge amount of profit, because ultimately, even a Levi Strauss pair of jeans is some denim cloth and a zip and a few other bits and pieces. The actual cost of the materials going to it are very small. What we're paying for is the brand image. And they managed to create that isolating mechanism. Preferential access. Here I'm thinking about, you know, Pfizer and AstraZeneca and pharmaceutical companies. Yes, they can outsource that production of the pills and the potions and the drugs to lots of other companies. But how do you sell pharmaceuticals? It's having access to doctors and hospitals and the medical community. And those manufacturers wherever in the world don't have that access. It's Pfizer and AstraZeneca that do it. And they could, and that's what enables them to outsource the manufacturing activities, because that's not a very important activity any longer. What's important is you've got the patents, you've got the access to the medical community. Product customization. Think about car companies here. Again, cars are no longer standard items. When you buy a new car, you get it customised, and it's the big car companies that are able to do this. And so they can outsource the production of all the bits and pieces and even the assembly of the cars to somebody else. It's having the distribution networks, the final sales networks, the after-sales service. This is their isolating mechanism. And it's when you've cracked that, when you've got something that isolates you from competition, that's when you can outsource all your activities and use that power that gives you to push down the costs, push down the prices, and you can make more profit out of it. Turning to my last issue, am I doing for time? The governance of the global factory. Right, I've said that each of these three models of the global factory has some kind of I think one can point to activities going on in the world economy which correspond to each of these models. Certainly, if we look to that global manufacturing system model, the idea that it's firms from emerging economies are growing up and becoming bigger and bigger. And yes, if one looks at some of the data and one looks at lists of multinationals, increasing numbers of these multinationals do come from emerging economies, from China, from Russia, from Brazil, and from all over the world. And to the extent that this is an important phenomenon, this focuses attention on some of the special features of firms coming out of emerging economies. And again, this is an important line of work in international business research. The idea in a lot of emerging economies, the industrial structure is characterized by business groups, chaebols in Korea and whatever else, groups which are bound together in some kind of informal way. A lot of firms in emerging economies are state-owned, have high degrees of state ownership. How does that affect things? How does that affect their strategies? Lots of firms in emerging economies, high degrees of family ownership. In Asia, I think the figure's up to 70%, so it's rather different from the sort of model of corporate ownership that we look at, certainly in Britain or in America, where share ownership is widely dispersed. And then governments getting involved through sovereign wealth funds. So what are the implications of having firms which are owned and controlled by business groups, state-owned enterprises, and governments through sovereign wealth funds? And what are the implications if this is, if you like, the dominant model of the global factory? What are the relationships between state and these big businesses? Obviously, state-owned enterprises are owned by the government. Sovereign wealth funds are funds which are controlled by the government. What are the implications for smaller private firms trying to develop in this kind of situation? Again, evidence around the world of various forms of discrimination against small private firms, discrimination in favour of state-owned enterprises. They get the export quotas, they get the finance, they get the preferential access to raw materials and things. And again, recent article I was just reading last week, financial constraints, this was looking in China, vary by ownership. In China, if you're a state-owned enterprise, money is readily available. If you're a private enterprise, it's more difficult to get hold of. And are these business groups, are they efficient? Do they facilitate growth of firms? Do they facilitate foreign direct investment? Or do they actually hamper these things? Is this something that works in emerging markets but doesn't work in a more globalised world? So there are issues here if we go along with this sort of model of the global factory, which is just a sort of greater dispersion of economic activity matched by a greater dispersion of ownership, throws up these kinds of issues. If one goes along with the Grunwald and Flam version of the global factory, multinationals offshoring a lot of their activities around the world, this suggests that a significant proportion of productive activity is actually still controlled by multinationals from advanced economies. And the few figures I put up a few slides ago about the importance of multinationals in the world economy seem to suggest that there's some truth to this as well. Though it has to be said that those UNCTAD figures would also include multinationals from emerging economies. But it seems as though there's, again, some truth to this. And lots of countries are worried about domination by foreign multinationals, concerned about loss of national sovereignty, concerned that foreign multinationals coming in, setting up manufacturing plants, when it suits them, they'll just shift production somewhere else. These investments are footloose. They're concerned about issues of transfer price manipulation as well, the big multinationals transcending national boundaries. These can all manipulate prices, reduce tax burdens, and this can have a negative impact upon development. On the other hand, some countries really welcome foreign investment. And that has implications, obviously, for industrial policy, economic development. Countries like Singapore, for example, seem to have actually done rather nicely, despite having, sort of foreign ownership of in excess of 50% in manufacturing. So obviously, foreign direct investment isn't necessarily a bad thing for all economies, and lots of governments these days are actively trying to increase foreign investment. And again, going back to a couple of very interesting articles back in the early 1990s by Robert Reich, who has since been Secretary of State in the US administration. Does it actually matter who owns the firms? Does it actually matter where a firm is headquartered? Maybe it's just what activity goes on in a particular country. So if one sort of goes along with the Grunwald and Flam idea of the global factory, does it really matter who owns things? Come on to the outsourcing and offshoring model. If this, to the extent that this is true, then certainly what we're seeing is a reduction in the ownership of productive capacity worldwide. If I think just about that particular example of Nike that I was talking about, at one stage Nike did own factories in America, and then it owned factories overseas, and now it doesn't own any factories. So in terms of ownership, there's been a reduction in the ownership of Nike overseas, and the same would be true for other companies. But for the reasons I was suggesting earlier, multinationals such as Nike, such as Pfizer, such as AstraZeneca, still retain control over what's going on. So to the extent to which this kind of model fits some of the facts, some of the reality in the world economy, again, what's the implications for economic development and industrial policy? Well, if one takes a positive spin on it, one would say that, well, you're providing opportunities for small firms. Nike is recruiting lots of firms around the world, so too is Dell, so too is Apple, so too is Pfizer, recruiting lots of firms in developing countries, in emerging economies, to do lots of work, to produce lots of manufacturing, to generate lots of employment. And again, I put up some numbers from UNCTAD about the scale of employment we're talking about here, quite substantial numbers. And it enables firms, maybe in developing economies or emerging economies, which can't produce computers or pharmaceuticals and sell them to advanced economies, to nevertheless get a part of the action. They can do bits of the value chain, the labour-intensive bits, the fairly simple bits, where they've got an advantage because of low labour costs or low environmental restrictions or whatever else. And by doing this, they gain access to export markets, to international markets, so they become exporters. So it provides opportunities to smaller firms. On the other hand, one might argue that, are these suppliers being exploited? Well, part of my explanation suggests probably they are, that a Nike or a Dell or an Apple, when it's outsourcing activities, why does it do it? It's because it wants to push down costs as much as it can. It wants to push down costs, it wants to get as, you know, so the supply prices are as low as they possibly can. And yes, is it exploitation if you know, Nike pays $1 for a pair of jeans, or sorry, for a pair of trainers, which is manufactured in Vietnam, and then sells them for $100 in America? Is that exploitation of these suppliers out in those emerging markets? Good question for debate. So are suppliers being exploited here, and the workers there being paid minimal wages? Now, the global value chain literature would say that maybe it provides an opportunity. What firms in this kind of position need to try and do is to try and upgrade their activities within these value chains. If you're always the little guy doing the really labour-intensive work, the simple work, yes, probably you are going to be exploited. You're never going to progress. You're never going to be able to develop. But there's always opportunities for upgrading, for trying to take on more of the activities in the value chain. And we see this in clothing value chains, that firms start off just doing the sewing and the and whatever else, but then take on more of the packaging and the design of the things, and you're trying to move up in the value chain. We see it too in electronics industry. Again, another, shall I say, infamous example, Foxconn, which regularly gets into the news. Foxconn started off life as one of those little supplier companies producing some components for one or two major sort of computer manufacturers, electronics goods manufacturers. It's grown quite considerably since then, and it doesn't just supply one or two computer manufacturers. Now it supplies Apple, Dell, Sony, Nintendo, Hewlett-Packard, Samsung, and other ones. It's got 20 plants in China. It's got more all around the world. It's managed to move up within this value chain to take on more and more of activity and to diversify its customer base. And by doing that, it's grabbing more of that power within the value chain itself. It's grabbing more of the power. It actually controls a lot of these small plants in China and around the world in a sense that Apple or Dell doesn't, because they're going through this intermediary now. And Foxconn is gradually accumulating more and more power. And again, a few figures just to show how big a company it is now. These are the top six outsourcing companies in the electronics industry back in 2010. There we got Foxconn sitting at the top of the pile there. $59 billion worth of sales, 611,000 employees. And these are the top six companies. They're all from emerging economies, Taiwan, Singapore, mostly in electronics. And the extent to which they're taking on this intermediary role, they're taking on more and more power. They're growing, they're developing, they're becoming more and more powerful. So, this kind of outsourcing, offshoring model of the global factory, again, there's a lot of it going on. This seems to resonate with a lot of the facts that we observe around the world. And this throws up a bunch of other interesting issues. There's all kinds of interesting issues here, enough to keep us all going for years and years and years. Who has responsibility within these devolved value chains for things like wage levels, for working conditions, for pollution and carbon emissions? Nike, over the years, the last 20, 30 years, regularly come under a lot of flack from the press, from the public, about the conditions in its factories out in Vietnam or Indonesia, the employment of child labour, the low wages that go on there, the appalling working conditions. And initially, Nike turned around and said, but they're not our factories. They belong to somebody else. They're owned by somebody else. We just buy from them. We provide custom, but we don't have any say over what goes on there. So that was their initial reaction. Over the years, public opinion has forced them to take a, shall I say, rather more enlightened perspective here, to say, well, actually, we do have some kind of responsibility here. And yes, we ought to put in people and check that working conditions are okay. We ought to pay a fair wage and whatever else. Rather more up to date, another example, Apple. The darling of the media these days, but again, coming under criticism in the press most recently, but only a couple of weeks ago, for what's going on in their supplier factories, Foxconn being one of them. Foxconn has had a string of suicides at its factories. Apple's come under a lot of criticism for child labour in these supplier factories, for cases of poisoning, for sweatshop conditions. Echoes of what Nike has been criticised for the last 20 or 30 years. And there was, again, article in the paper no more than a couple of weeks ago, how Apple has enlisted this Washington organisation called the Fair Labour Association to do some audits of its factories. Now, the Fair Labour Association, that sounds good, doesn't it? Fair labour, that's what we're all in favour of. That's got to be a good organisation. But again, if you go back and do the Nike case study, you find out that the Fair Labour Association was set up by Nike back in 1999. It was a smokescreen then, and I'm not going to comment now. I'm on camera, so I'm not going to say anything more. Final comments then. Yes, I'm running short of time. What we observe in the world economy, major changes in the location of economic activity. That much is clear. Particularly in the emerging economies, maybe also in developing economies, much more manufacturing activity going on, much more service activity as well. But who keeps control over these activities, I think, is an area that we haven't yet fully researched. Or putting it, say, in sort of terms of my lecture here, who's governing this global factory that's being established? And who's getting the profits? Who's earning all the rents here? And here's where I see a real synergy between the work which Hubert and John Humphrey have been doing in IDS and colleagues around the world, and a lot of IB work, that there's that the interchange between these two lines of research, there's some very fruitful work to be done there. And to finish, Professor Marlin mentioned a little plug for my conference. The European International Business Academy is holding its annual conference here at the University of Sussex next December, 7th to the 9th of December. It's going to be organised by myself and my colleague Pervez Gari, who you're going to hear from in a few minutes' time. Our theme is international business and sustainable development. And we're going to hold a plenary session with Hubert and John Humphrey. You're going to talk about their work. Have a gala dinner down in the Grand Hotel, and further details available on the website. And I've finished.